Hello and welcome to today's MadTech podcast. It's a change of pace for today's episode as we bring you the highlights from our exclusive Road to ATS event, which took place in Singapore on March the 16th. Our expert panel gave us the inside track on what's shaping the industry across APAC in 2023. Tickets for ATS Singapore, which takes place on October 3rd and 4th, 2023, are available now at exchangewire.com/events. Over to moderator, ExchangeWire's COO Lindsay Rountree, and the rest of the panel. Enjoy.
This really is a chance for us to be able to kind of, from a cross-section of the industry, understand what in region and in market is really shaping what 2023 looks like. Lee gave us some really interesting insight there, and there'll be a chance to kind of delve into that further with different people across the industry. So before we kick off, let's introduce ourselves. I mean, everyone knows I'm Lindsay, as Anne-Marie just said. Silas, I'm going to start with you, please.
Morning, everyone. I'm Silas. I'm the head of media business units globally for Haleon. Haley who, you might ask?
Haley who? So
last year, in the middle of the year, GSK spun off their consumer healthcare division. So we're the largest consumer healthcare company in the world that you've never heard of. Panadol.
Panadol, there we go. Gorman, you please.
Yeah, cool. Hi guys, I'm Gorman Hundle, co-founder and exec chairman of MIQ. Ultimately, we help run programmatic media campaigns for agencies and clients, and we have a whole suite of programmatic executional products that we work with across clients across the world.
Brilliant, thank you. And Raj, so I can barely see, I'm going to move around a bit. There we go.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm Raj. I lead the digital sales and strategy team at MediaCorp. For those who are not from Singapore, MediaCorp is the largest digital publisher in Singapore. And for those who still don't get it, we are like the BBC of Singapore, yeah, as I was telling Lindsay.
Yes, that's very, very helpful analogy. Thank you very much. Avis.
Hi, so I'm Avis. I'm from Lux Asia. We're the brands behind the brands you buy. So we do beauty, we do luxury lifestyle. So you'll know us as La Prairie, Bulgari, Dyson, Lego, Dettol, Durex, all of those. And we're in 15 countries across Asia Pacific. And you'll notice we don't have Twitter because it's irrelevant.
Shot fired there. Great, great start. Caroline, finally.
Hi, I'm Caroline. I'm the Vice President of Sales for StackAdapt. We are a programmatic advertising platform. We were founded in Canada over 10 years ago, and we launched in the APAC region, in Australia and Singapore, just over a year ago now.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, everyone. So I want to kick off by, I guess, drawing on a lot of what Lee was talking about just now, and speak about the economy and the impact of a potential global recession on Asia. And I guess also Southeast Asia. You know, Asia has seen a lot of growth. And that's great, but are there concerns from the brand side, from the publisher side, from tech publishers? And also, how does that look, what that look like from a kind of global versus local perspective? So I was going to come to you first, because obviously you work for a global company. So how does a global company deal with this, and what does that look like for you regionally? And obviously, you've got a global role as well. So,
sure. So I think there's a few things to discuss and unpack in all of that. So obviously, you've seen the trends that Lee talked about. I mean, we ran for the WFA surveys at the end of last year. It quite clearly shows that there's not a consistency in where ad investment's going to go this year, right? And APAC will obviously weather the economic challenges much better than any other region. But when you work in a global country, you can't, or company, you can't sit back and say, don't worry, we're fine out here. You guys in Western Europe, suck it up and deal with your own investment issues. Everyone here who works on the brand side or on the agency side is going to be faced with questions about why do I need to maintain my investment in Asia? I know you guys are growing. I'm struggling elsewhere. Where do I need to profit protect, et cetera? And so while on the surface everything seems fine, I think we all need to be prepared for the conversations that are coming, which are going to be about why it's important to maintain investment, how brands grow during downturns, and all of those tropes, which I know we all know and we all use, but really reinforce those. And it's great to see and great to be in this part of the world where we see the growth rates happening, not only in terms of business and advertising, but in population. There's so much opportunity here, and it's being able to express that to people who are not from here and defend yourself in that kind of environment, which I think a lot of brands are going to need to do.
Interesting. And Avis, from your perspective, you're a local company. You said 15 markets across Asia. Everything's going well and strongly for you. Kind of, does the global recession impact you in any way? Do you have concerns about it?
I mean, yeah, we sell European brands to Asia. So there is a challenge that if our brands aren't doing well, if the brands don't have, you know, supply chain quality, they won't get the products to us. So our biggest problem is empty shelves, if I'm really honest. If we're doing our job well, global recession for us just means it gets harder to get stuff here. And it also means we don't necessarily get the priority, because global brands will want to succeed in their own countries. You know, you're not going to have a French or Italian brand going, yeah, we really suck here, but boy, we're doing great in Singapore. You know, that's not how life works. So globally it affects us. We are bullish. We are very bullish, because what a lot of global brands are doing now is going, oh, to hell with doing it myself. That idea that everyone was going to come to Asia and they were going to set up their big head office and they were going to take it all themselves and they were going to conquer Asia has been kind of come back now. And people are going, no, you do that. You have the infrastructure. You have the experience. You have the connections. I want to make this margin. So I think it becomes easier and a little harder, you know, but yeah, it's just business, isn't it, really?
It's always just business. Gordon, I want to come to you and understand from MIQ's perspective, you know, as a global tech company, and also, you know, working with global brands, how the economy is affecting MIQ and affecting your clients, because, you know, one feeds the other. So what's it look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I've probably got a few key insights. One, clients are definitely being very sort of short term and changing their mind. So, you know, one of the things we track just from a sales perspective is what we call downweight, like how many times does a client book something and then a week or two later, so half the budget. That rate is very, very high right now. So there's a lot of short-term decisions how they're moving budgets around. But I still think there's areas of big growth that we're still seeing, even in a downturn. So it's like the CTV, that whole space, we're just still seeing double-digit growth in terms of just advertisers migrating from linear TV to CTV.
And that tracks across every region, CTV?
Yeah, but in regions where there's more sort of control by the suppliers, maybe less so.
Yeah.
So where there's a lot of broadcasters who control a lot of the viewership, where there's a bit more broader, like what we call like streaming video on demand, or subscription, sorry, video on demand, and they're taking advertising or free ad-funded streaming services, where there's a lot of consumption of them, that's where probably the revenue of CTV is driving. Where the consumption is sort of on the big broadcasters on demand channels, it's still probably not growing as much. But yeah, generally, yeah, we have seen, and I saw a chart the other day, like you always see these sort of market research charts, but one of the real good ones is a lot of listed companies in ad tech right now, and there's ways you can just sort of aggregate their growth, and it's really interesting of like 30 companies who are relying on ad tech revenue, just seeing what their growth rates are by quarter. And it's the first time ever we've dropped below 10% in the ad tech in Q4, and Q1's under 5% is what the projections are from those companies.
Does that general trend cause you concern?
For me, it's like, I actually think Lee made a good word about prioritizing right now. But the other thing is, be patient. It will spin out. You know, there's never, ever been a... you know, we're not going to get into a great decade depression. I don't think that's going to happen. So my view is think what I've noticed in advertising, even in 08 or in 2020 in Q2, like the bounce back is huge. And it might be 2024 or something like that. I think my advice would be just be patient, ride it out, prioritize your investments. There's still areas of growth.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've got products in those areas of growth, that's where you can prioritise.
Caroline, I see you nodding away over there. Slack Adapt, another global company going through growth. Kind of, what are you seeing in region from your clients?
Yeah, well, I think at this point we weren't imagining things to be quite as good. I think when January came, it was a little bit doom and gloom, but come February and March, you know, we're in APAC here. Q1 is always a slow quarter for us, both in Australia and across the Southeast Asia region. However, we are seeing budgets grow. And actually, unlike Gorman, we're seeing advertisers and brands being a bit more strategic now in what they're doing for throughout the year and actually planning a bit further in advance. So we are seeing budgets grow, probably because now we can do everything multi-channel. So we can bring budgets online, we can optimize across channel, we can measure, we can pull reports, we can move money around. It's really, really flexible. So actually, we're seeing that helping us help our brands to grow money. So really, sort of positive start to the year for us.
Great, very positive. And Raj, coming to you finally as the publisher in the room and the BBC of Singapore, of course. What are you seeing from the clients, the advertisers that you work with and the tech partners you work with, and how is maybe some reticence from them to spend or spend in certain areas? How is that affecting your ability to do business and your ability to create revenue, drive revenue from advertising?
So, you know, one thing we've seen is news inventory has really catapulted after the pandemic, right? So there's a lot of more people spending much more time on news. They want to get the latest updates. And now it's almost become like a habit forming situation where they check news as much as probably they check their social media, right? And once it becomes a habit and you have that traffic on your platforms and your apps, you certainly see more demand from advertisers. And advertisers recognize the difference between, you know, publishers who operate in the news space, in the premium space, versus like social media, versus other publishers, lifestyle, what have you. So that's one thing that advertisers have generally adapted to. And I think they because they see that stickiness, they see the traffic increase, and they see the kind of time spent, it's a big leap forward. Right, so it's kind of a good thing for us, right? The second part to that is that while we saw that huge traffic surge, that surge has now come down because there's no longer the news around COVID, right? But what habit formation does is, you know, you flick your phone out in the morning and you still go on to news. You know, there's a war happening, there's banks being uprooted and whatnot, right? And it's about giving certain data points to advertisers or brands for them to understand where they can get a better return of investment. So we recently did a study on just scroll time or just a scroll speed. So we saw that we have you know, a 4x slower scroll speed than social media, for example. Right, just on any article you read on a CNA, for example, versus you reading it on Facebook, right? And that's huge because advertisers want to buy space in either one of those platforms, but they also want higher viewability. They also want a higher attention metric. They also want their creative to be seen. You know, at the end of the day. So those are the changes that we've seen. So advertisers are now recognizing where sort of news publishers, premium digital publishers sit, and increasing their investment slow and steady.
Interesting. And you've got higher engagement, higher traffic. Yes, it's gone down again, but you know, think things are generally good from that perspective. Are there? But the news isn't great. I mean, we've talked. You just mentioned some things there yourself. You know, we've got a war. We've got banks collapsing left, right, and centre. Is that affecting, is the fact that what is probably often being read as bad news, is that affecting how you can sell inventory? Are advertisers still using, you know, a bit of a hangover from the pandemic where the block lists were going crazy, everyone was trying to block everything bad, despite the fact that it might have been a good news story or an important story, and actually that's where the user is, so I need to be in front of them. Are you still finding that to be a concern?
So that's a huge concern because, you know, we've seen traffic surge, but at the same time, there's a huge amount of traffic that is unsafe. It's brand unsafe. And most of the investment that we see on news or even on our lifestyle, on our OTT, is brand safety being sort of the prime metric for us, right? Because we are brand safe and we are premium, right? And that's why we command the place we sit in. But there is a good 10, 15% of inventory which we just can't sell because it's unsafe.
10, 15%.
And what we do is we don't usually get clients to give us a block list. So there is a tier one unsafe inventory that's not sold to any client. So it could be a client who's spending $5,000 with us, or it could be a client who's spending $100,000 with us. They get the same brand safety applied to their campaigns, right? Because it should be across everyone, as well as programmatic campaigns that we see on our platforms.
Interesting. I want to move us on because there's so much to talk about in terms of what we're looking at for 2023. I want to bring us on sustainability next. And understand what that looks like in this region, what that looks like for you as companies. Again, we've got the kind of global versus local perspective here as well, which I think makes it very interesting. We're certainly seeing kind of where I'm sitting in the UK, there's a lot more talk around sustainability, and it's largely been driven by regulation. It's not been driven by a kind of genuine kind of want or need to actually be more sustainable and reduce emissions within the advertising industry. But there is that want, but then things like recessions kind of cause, you know, it costs money to be sustainable. I want to understand what that's looking like in region over here and what you guys are seeing kind of, I guess, from the company perspective and how it tracks across different markets. Gorman, I'm going to come to you first on kind of what MIQ are doing in this space and how you're trying to work out how you can reduce the emissions of MIQ and help your clients through that journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of demand for this. I think it's coming from it's a sort of a topic on any board meeting at any company right now is ESG, and so any ideas are heard, right? And one of the I think programmatic ecosystem is really designed for this. So we were one of the first companies, we partnered with a company called Scope 3, it was founded by Brian O'Kelly, who was founder of Nexus Sander. And what you can effectively do, leveraging their insight, is ultimately score every bid request around how many emissions it's going, and that's on computing power, number of chains in their sort of tag system, and then just generally a score of what that publisher is, and you can just dynamically optimize away from those pages or those publishers. And we do that for our clients. If they want us to flick that algorithm on, we flick it on for them. And we're seeing a big uptake in that. And it's an easy win for a client to say, I can tick this feature on my programmatic campaigns, and it means that I am running them in areas where emissions are lower. And that sort of plays up to their corporate requirements, which are getting pushed down a lot. But it's actually, we're in an industry where I think it's very, very easy to offer that to clients.
That is interesting that you're saying it's easy and something that can fundamentally just be switched on. Raj, are you seeing from a property perspective, are you getting those kinds of requests through from advertisers that want to produce it? No, he's shaking his head. No.
So I see it on panels like this. It's a great topic to discuss. We've seen a lot of conversations, but they don't really translate to a campaign level. So when brands are investing money for campaigns and when they're running campaigns on our platforms, we don't see sustainability as the top KPI. It's not the top metric. So it's still things like brand safety, viewability, attention metric is now a buzzword. But sustainability isn't something we see very often. And there are, I think the key reason for that is because brands don't want to pay extra dollars for that. If you can do it within my CPM, well and good. You know, if you can do it within my CPA, well and good. But they don't want to pay that premium for that. But love to hear some other thoughts.
Yeah, just look on that. It's a good point there. Like, as an industry, we went through, right, what's the brand safety score, what's the viewability score, what's the fraud rate? I actually do think that will become another stat on every campaign. Isn't like, what's the emission
like
rate?
A hygiene factor type
hygiene
yeah.
factor and emission factors can't go below above X or something like that. I do think that will be the future of how sustainability gets our ecosystem.
Silas, this must be a big topic for you guys.
So it's a tricky one, obviously. We're a CPG company and the P word struggles in a sustainability world. But that doesn't mean that while our supply chain and packaging friends in the company are working hard to reduce virgin plastic use or reduce plastic use overall or water use. We can't just sit on the sidelines and wait. So I think part of the requirements internally have been about setting expectations and targets for ourselves in terms of how we can responsibly divert money from, I guess, what I would call a standard approach to buying, into buying which offers some kind of good. Now, that good isn't only sustainability. That absolutely includes things like DEI, which is very core and fundamental to our culture internally. But sustainability has to be a part of that as well. And I agree with Gurman. I mean, the reality is these will become part of our new wave of hygiene KPIs that we look at. And, you know, Raj talked about attention. That will be another part of that discussion as well. And I think that starts to change the way we evaluate media and how we evaluate our buys. And for us, that's becoming a big part of the conversation internally. I also think there's this notion in that responsibility as a large-scale investor about what you can do for the world, right? And I think a lot of us in marketing have frequently sat on the sidelines of doing good because we're not viewed as good, right? I mean, no one cheers for the ads when they come on generally, right? I mean,
this they really should do that.
This is,
I mean,
except
honestly,
in the Super Bowl, right? So buy Super Bowl ads, right? But beyond that, that's the reality of where we sit. So I think many of us, especially in companies whose orientation is designed to bring good into society, and you know, we can talk about, you know, what we believe in that, but I do believe that that's allowing many of us in an industry and a function which has historically not been able to participate, be able to participate and, you know, try to deliver something which is better for society. So that's resonating internally with our people. And that's huge. I mean, you know, you work at two different companies. One company who says, I don't care about, you know, these sorts of responsibility aspects, and you work at another company where these do. You can start to see who, the kind of talent you can retain, the work that people do. So everyone talks about, oh, the value of sustainability, the value of DEI. It's not just about the value to society. It's also the value internally to the company and the way people react. And we absolutely see that carrying through in our internal surveys and how people feel. Like, as we talk about, hey, you need to spend X percentage of your dollars in responsible media, you're there. I guess the last point I'll make in that before I get off my soapbox is this notion of ease that you talked about is so critical. So yeah, we sit in a global level, and we're like, everyone needs to invest X percent, and all our local teams are like, oh, right? I don't know how to do that. I've got all this extra work to do now. Vendors and partners who build turnkey solutions in these spaces early are gonna win, because it will become so simple for you know, a brand in a local market to say, I know the global teams are doing, you know, suggesting I need to do this. I believe in it too, but I don't have enough time. I've got a million things to do. Oh, this partner offers it for us. Wow. Okay, well, fine. Just divert that percentage over to them. Done. Yeah. I can tick the box, right? And so I think we're impressing upon this to everyone who will listen. And it's not just in sustainability. It's in things like DEI as well. Being able to offer solutions to clients in those spaces is going to be a game changer and a quick winner for you, even though it may not be a quick winner to implement.
Are you asking that of your tech partners? Are you asking them to come to you with solutions about how you can invest in responsible media, how things can be more sustainable?
I think I just did, but anyway. but yes, absolutely, especially with some of our larger, regular strategic partners in the digital space. Is that vague enough?
It's very vague. Thank you for that. Yeah. I'm going to move us on to measurement because of the discussion around, you know, can we make sustainability a hygiene factor like we're doing with viewability, et cetera. And Raj, I want to come to you first on measurement and what the marketers that you work with are asking for from you. When we spoke the other day, we talked about attention. I mentioned the word attention and you laughed, because you said I would love it if more of the clients we work with would talk about attention, but they're not really. They all want viewability. Is that an issue with this region, that viewability is too much of a focus, more of a focus than it should be, certainly for you as a premium publisher?
So viewability is now hygiene in all campaign buys. It's something we do. We work with pretty much every client. 99 out of 100 campaigns we run. And within the viewability space, we've developed like what we call as a viewability calculator that essentially calculates what different ad formats can get in terms of viewability, right? And when we run campaigns, we have a bundle of different ad formats. So it could be display, it could be video, it could be rich media, high impact, what have you, right? Each of these come with its own sort of viewability percentage. A lot of us know high impact formats don't necessarily get the greatest viewability, but they get the highest CTRs, right? So there's that push and pull there. But what that viewability calculator helps us do is it gives us, it sort of customizes, it's like that magic bullet that customizes the media plan to hit that viewability percentage for an advertiser or for a campaign. So brands that usually look at 70% or 75%, it just calculates that for them, right? And that's one of the key measurement tools from what we've been seeing. Attention is a big one. And again, attention is similar to, I think, sustainability as a conversation, where it's sort of up and coming, but it's not quite there yet. And I think it's more about not only from a publisher standpoint, but even from an advertiser standpoint or from an agency standpoint. The three of us just need to come together and devise what is it that we really want within that space, because it's a big question mark at the moment. We do our own sort of internal surveys in terms of seeing, like I said, the scroll speed, you know, being slower, being lesser. There's higher viewability, there's higher sort of attention in general, but that's about it as of now.
Interesting. And Avis, I want to hear from you about LuxAsia and measurement and what's important to you. It's very apparent that obviously this region is very performance focused. I would say that in terms of kind of what your KPIs are, what you're looking at, it's performance, right?
Yeah, make money. I mean, that's it, isn't it? You know, every dollar you spend, make more back. Yeah, that's the answer we're looking for. But you have to take a wider view on all of this. So yes, of course, you have to make money with your marketing dollars, but there's also a bit above the line where you have to make sure your brands stay, you know, luxury and desirable and, you know, continue to be in people's minds. But I think we have to take a wider view than just the marketing of all of this. So, you know, when we talk sustainability, for example, I don't think about it as saving the world and, you know, how my marketing dollars go. I mean, that's a bit too, you know, esoteric for me. I think about it as staff retention, because we're 66, 70% millennial now and younger. I think of it as how we win new business in the future, because I know our brand owners will be looking for sustainable partners in Asia, and I will have that accreditation if it kills me. We'll be the first distributor to get there, and no one else will be able to do it, and you'll have to come to us. So for all of these things, I think of it very much, how do we, LuxAsia, put money on the bottom line and make sure that brands have nowhere else to go? So, yes, it is the fact that we can look across the whole marketing ecosystem and I can advise brands based on one brand's performance in this country. You know, 100 brands don't have to test it. I've tested it with 3. We know the results. We know where to focus. We know what not to do. And we're very blessed. If you've got 140 brands, you learn fast and you can disseminate that fast. But mainly, I think you have to look at marketing as part of the wider business. Where are we going? We're going to growth, a big mega growth. We're bringing more brands in. For us, everything is about how do we, as this distributor in the middle, you know, you've got the brands, we've got the landlords, the retailers, the e-tailers, everyone out there, the marketplaces, how do we protect our margins? And I think for us, it's about not caring about vanity. And as marketeers, it's very easy to go, oh, I did this, I've got this amount of reach, I've got this amount of impressions. And I kind of sit there going, like, give me money, I'll get you those things. You know, how many do you want? Give me dollars. But I think it's easy. You know, our brands sometimes only work in that space. That's great. But I've got a warehouse full of stuff and I need to sell it because it's going to expire. And that focuses your mind more than anything else. How do I move this from my cost with my cash flow to you lovely people who give me money that make me profit? And that, once you get that into your head every day, that becomes very liberating. You don't care about the channel. You don't care about the dwell times. You don't, you know, you do care about the hygiene, you know, if I mess up. You know, very early on, we had an influencer strategy. And one of our luxury skincare brands chose an influencer. And basically, they ended up with people who were teenagers stroking their cats, saying how much they loved the influencer. It was totally wrong. So I care about, you know, doing it right. But mainly, I care about using the right thing at the right time and making money. And once you do that, it gets much easier, really, I think.
The classic marketing metrics, basically. Caroline, from your perspective, what are your clients looking for? Like, you know, you mentioned a very performance-focused region. Do you wish it weren't? Do you wish there were kind of other? It feels like there's a kind of either too performance focused or too vanity metric focused. It's something. What's the in between what CTR is and what the CPA is, and kind of what are you wanting to guide your clients into?
Yeah, well, I guess I can just sort of continue from what Avis was saying here. Our clients, our brands, the agencies we work with, they want flexibility. So they want to be able to come to us to work in a programmatic environment across multi-channel and be able to optimize. They want to use different performance metrics, whether it's CBC, CPA, CPE, and do all of that under one umbrella and then all to optimize towards what is performing best. So again, a bit of what Avery was saying here. So, you know, delve into that, optimize towards the best performing channel. Ultimately, it's about selling. Ultimately, it's about ROI and having that focus and flexibility.
Silas, what are important KPIs for you? Because it must be more challenging because you are not your manufacturer. You don't sell directly. So what is important to you? What do you guys look for when you're investing marketing budget?
So I think it diverges a bit from what Avis talked about, because while we know that when we're effective and we optimize, we make more money than we put in, the challenging reality and the one that no one likes to talk about is the fact that when we build brands over longer periods of time, we make even more money, right? So while things like attention or sustainability may feel like vanity and surface metrics, they start to bridge the gap for us between what are truly wasted KPIs, like CTR and clicks. Waste. Just fundamentally a waste of time. And a challenge for us, because we don't have conversion events, as you talked about. So it's a natural place where everyone wants to gravitate to, right? Well, I can count that. That's great. And I know someone did something. They didn't really, but anyway. So I think that starts to fundamentally adjust how we think about the value that media returns, right? Now, you know, I know a lot of people use ROI as a tactic for that. I mean, for me, ROI is more of an efficiency metric. ROAS is probably more towards where we want to get to as a way to demonstrate, you know, that return. But for us, more and more, it's about the contribution to the business. So what we look for is revenue contribution coming out of media and how much of that is coming from the money we put in and how much of that is coming over longer periods of time when we divert some of our money away from, I guess, what I would refer to as more short-term promotional product-driven messaging, okay, to a balance between that and some longer-term emotive brand-building messaging over time. Now, that's a journey, right? I mean, you don't see the returns on that investment right away, so it's scary as hell, right? But the reality is, you know, there's enough industry knowledge out there. You know, long and short's been out for a decade now. We have enough brands who have done the journey and seeing the positive results to really ground ourselves in reframing a lot of our KPIs. And some of those KPIs return to being boring ones, like reach. I mean, I know it's boring, but the reality is penetration comes from reach in a lot of cases. And reach can be delivered through a variety of channels. And I think that's the game that we play in terms of maximizing that. And, you know, effective reach or quality reach when you start to layer on things like attention are also really interesting. But those are the kinds of spaces which we're starting to operate in. And it doesn't take away from the performance side. It's the and, you know, or the bothism, whoever you want to quote there, that starts to get us into that space.
It's really interesting because the view of a brand is very different from the view of a distributor. And we deliberately will not work with brands who don't understand that, because otherwise we end up doing that, but they don't give us enough margin to do that. So you have to get your partnerships right, because if we don't have brands like you guys that really understand how to make it desirable in the first place, it doesn't matter what it is. If nobody knows about that brand and that product, you can't sell it. You just can't create the demand. So that's why it becomes really useful to have the right partners, because they deliver that. The partners that think just by putting something shelf in Asia and people will come and drag it off, well, that's just funny. So I'm not saying they're not valuable. Of course they're not, that they're valuables. They're just not valuable to me, because I expect brands to do it. But they are so important to brands, because if you don't get it there, you're never going to sell a thing. So yeah, I absolutely get where you're coming from. Yeah,
lots of wonderful synergy going on here. I love it. Gorman, I want to come to you about the attention economy. It's a big topic being talked about a lot, and understand, you know, what attention means to your clients and how you're working with them to understand, you know, so clients like Haleon is a great example. They haven't got first party data. How are they managing capabilities to ensure they can still target effectively? What role does context play in that? And kind of, what are you guys, what are MIQ doing in that space?
Yeah, I think sort of attention will be measured, is sort of measured differently, but depending on the device and whatever the ad unit is, so like scrolling rates, things like that on papers. One area that I found fascinating is in the TV space, and it's this, I don't know how long it will last actually though, this will, from a privacy perspective, but there's these new technologies coming out, sort of tracking your eyeballs around adverts shown on TVs, and having a panel that basically is your sort of seed data to sort of say, actually this user was very engaged on your TV advert, they weren't walking around and things like that. That kind of innovation I could see for marketers is highly valuable insight. It's like, you know, it's taking viewability almost to the next level and taking it into TV.
I mean, it sounds dodgy as sin, but yeah, sure.
But there's a lot of companies very well funded recently.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree, yeah.
Are doing that. But it's, you know, it's a basis of an opt-in panel. We put a little camera on their TV and then they basically get paid for that, just like the Barb. All these sort of things. So I think I think clients are certainly the big branding clients are keen on that. But I'm not personally. I've not seen it. The demand be, you know, I haven't seen that high level of passion for that really yet. You know, and that high level of just sort of buy in. I need this on my campaign, etc. I've seen more on sustainability. Than those things, to be fair. And I think what the brands will want to see is how is it linked to people buying goods.
Yeah. It all comes ultimately back down to that, where it can, of course. And that leads me into cookies, obviously. We've got to talk about cookies at some point, and first-party data, and what everyone is doing to mitigate the demise of the third-party cookie. Are we looking at things like context and things like measuring attention? Are we looking at IDs? Are we looking at a hybrid approach? Raj, from a publisher perspective, you know, what have you guys been doing at MediaCorp to ready yourselves for a world without cookies? Kind of, how does that work for you?
So we've, I mean, even before this came about, we've been strengthening our first-party data since now 5 years. So we have a pretty robust strategy in terms of what we wanted to do with first-party data, starting from 2017, 2018. And the thing is, we have a lot of audiences on our platforms who, you know, single sign on, right? And then they are either reading a piece of news on CNA, they are watching a show on MeWatch, they're reading some lifestyle content on 8Days and so on. We have newsletter data. So all of that combined, we've put together a first-party solution, which is proprietary. And we've not really waited for the third-party demise. So now that's moved into a very robust space. What we have been doing after the news of the third-party demise came out a year, 2 years back, is we've started testing 100% first-party data on our campaigns. And previously, we had a combination of first and third party. And what that did is it gave us a lot more scale. So there's declared and inferred both on first as well as third party, But now we've removed that third party and said, let's just test first party, both declared inferred, and see how that scales up. And can it deliver a campaign in its entirety? Right? If it can, then we are at the right space to operate if and when the third party is removed. And we've been doing that for, so we started with display. We then moved on to video. I think video is the only one that that we need to fully sort of transform into, because it's a space that's also exponentially growing. So you spoke about CTV earlier. We've seen a huge surge in CTV. I mean, all of us have been binging on shows, right? And buying new TVs in the last 3 years. So that's a sort of a crystal ball or a black box, which we don't know much about, but it's the views are there, the people are there. What do we do in terms of data there? But yeah, that's the overall strategy.
Interesting. Silas, is Halion is ready for the loss of cookies? Is MediaCorp is? Or are you shaking in your boots?
Seems like a very 2022 conversation, actually, Lindsay. But
it's ethereal, I think. Yeah,
it's a never-ending conversation. Thankfully, yeah. Thanks to Google, who can't seem to get their acts together in that. Strike that from the record. So I think when this was a really hot topic, so to speak, last year, we did a lot of work to sort of pressure tests. And, you know, sometimes it's good not to sell directly to consumers, I'll say, right? Because obviously there's less impact in cookie deprecation in terms of the way we operate. But it started to unearth through a lot of testing and learning, you know, back to what's old is new, areas that we used to operate in, but, you know, stopped for a variety of reasons, like context. And context is obviously pulling in our testing last year pretty substantially better than we expected. And it starts to open up a lot of discussions around, you know, how far down the targeting path we went and whether at times we were being inefficient in that targeting when actually a slightly wider cohort perhaps would have performed better, you know, at an overall perspective from cost versus benefit. So I think that's opened a lot of people's eyes to that reality. And, you know, as you so helpfully stated, our first party data is a bit less robust than we would like.
You can't get loads of email addresses from someone trying to buy toothpaste.
I know you all want to go to a Sensodyne website later, but unfortunately I don't think you will, or you want to figure out what Panadol does for you, then I can talk to you about that. But the reality is, you know, Google's response, for example, is site cookies, right? Just build up that data as people come to your environment. And of course they're going to say that because that's self-serving to them, but it also starts to call into question, you know, do we really even need brand.com sites? The reality is we can recreate the kind of information that we need to serve from a safety perspective, from a dosage perspective, from even a brand perspective, in a lot of third-party e-commerce platforms. And so do I want to create a friction point between my advertising and the opportunity for someone to convert? I know I was just talking about Brandigo. I'm just making sure everyone knows I do care about selling. But that reality is that all of that sort of engagement with our brand can occur in those environments. Now, the trade-off is obviously no data collection.
Yeah.
But was I going to get that data anyway is the bigger question for me.
Probably not.
No, I don't think so, right? So that's some of the trade-offs in the conversations we're having now, which is, you know, obviously some pretty substantial conversations in an organization where a lot of people have spent a lot of time building these beautiful, engaging, detailed brand environments, right? You know, you don't want to build that nice house and not live in it. So that's the kind of scenario we're in now. And I think it's about finding the balance between those two, because there are moments and there are elements and components of our brands where people do need information and we want to own that. And there are products which are habitual. You know, if you need to clean your dentures every day, then maybe you don't care about like going to the shop and buying the tablet to clean them every day. You want to just have someone send them to you. And there's a value exchange there. So it's about trying to unlock where those value exchanges are and use those in those scenarios and then remove points of friction where it doesn't really matter and we just want to make it easy for someone to purchase.
Indeed. I need to move us on because we're fast amount of time. But Caroline, I want to come to you and I want to talk about channel selection. I want to understand where your clients are spending their money.
And if you think that's changed, and kind of what, you know, we've talked about CTV, for example, and live commerce came up a lot in the Q&A with Lee Terry. What trends are you seeing, and are you seeing a shift anywhere?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really changed because, you know, historically media buying, the channels were bought very separately. You know, some bought programmatically, some bought direct, but now we can actually buy all channels in one place. So we're seeing more dollars moving programmatically for sure. You know, Australia's way ahead, but we're seeing that trend now coming to Southeast Asia, where we've also got the emergence and the rise of the independent agencies as a result of this, because, you know, historically you just had a creative agency, you had a media buying agency. Now some of the creative agencies are actually building in-house programmatic teams so they can buy everything and also do the creative. So yeah, we're seeing that huge shift there, which is really interesting. Ultimately, again, it goes down to performance. So the great thing about having all the different channels in one place means you can auto-optimize across the channels, whether it's digital out of home, whether it's native, whether it's display. You can actually see in real time which one's performing better. You can have different performance metrics for each channel, and then you can you know, move your budget accordingly. So we are seeing the rise as well, that the budgets are getting bigger, not smaller. And I think that's why we're probably seeing quite a positive outcome this year, even though, you know, we are in a global downturn. Programmatic buying is not. We're not seeing that. We're seeing the rise.
Very positive. Avis, where's your marketing budget go? Not Twitter, obviously.
Who am I going to talk to? I mean, it's Asia.
Elon Musk, probably.
Yeah, so I am an internal agency. I've got creatives, I've got build teams, you know, I've got social paid media buyers. And we also look at email, SMS, line, fiber, you know, all those good things that you need to work in Asia. So to me, it's a really easy thing. You know, you test all of them, you work out what works at what level for that brand, you keep testing, because what happened in 11/11 isn't going to happen in 3/3, that's for sure. And you just keep going, and just you're perpetually surprised by how consumer demand changes and how different groups buy different things. So for us, we tested every channel you can imagine. We love TikTok. It doesn't love us. I'm waiting for TikTok shopping to really get going.
I was going to say, is live commerce something that you are exploring? Oh, like, we talk about it in China, but I don't know if there's much of it here yet.
Live commerce is everywhere. So we have our own social studio, we have a lifestyle area, we have green screens, we have a photography studio, we have makeup areas. Yeah, we do that. I don't think of that as anything different. I just think of that as what you do. That's just content. And it's only when I go to Europe and then I talk to people and they talk about, you know, in hushed tones, live commerce. Mm. And I'm like, what? Yeah, that's just it's just a thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
We're I mean, not, it's, we're, it's we're, not. We're a bit scared
yeah,
of that. At the
I,
moment,
I never think to talk about it, because it's something that happens. We will habitually get an influencer and a trainer or a member of a staff, or we'll get our customers together and we will do a small live commerce selling program. And remember, we sell expensive stuff, so we're not volume like you guys. We sell big baskets to not many people. So, you know, you just keep trying. Try different things. And then you look at the big trends and you go, okay, let's go to China. Let's get Austin, bless him. He's out again, to come and sell for us. And so then you look at your return on it. And if you break even, you consider yourself to be doing really well. And what you end up deciding sometimes is that in this live commerce environment, you're buying the influencer and the influencer's fans loving that influencer. You're not buying repeat purchase. So you have to be in the game to play it. I can't wait till TikTok shop really gets going. It hasn't quite yet. We do a huge percentage of our online shopping from Instagram, just click it through to web. All these little things, they add up. But where do you go? It depends what that campaign is. It depends what color it is. Like, if it's going to be cool tones, I'm not going to try and sell it in Malaysia because they like bright tones. So I sometimes look at things and go, that's a great product. That's never going to work where I want to sell it. I'm going to have to create my own content. And that's where I go, live selling or somewhere else. So, you know, it's just an everyday marketing decision, isn't it? Where do you go? Is it going to give you value? And are you going to make a return on it? And then there's the bit that says you have to keep investing in new channels. You have to keep testing your mix because it just changes so fast. And I love that about that, by the way. Otherwise, marketing would be really dull, wouldn't it? If it just, you did this and you get that, it'd be like, oh.
Gorman, you've been quite bullish on CTV. What else are you seeing? What trends are you seeing in terms of where media budgets are going? What are your clients talking to you about?
So definitely on the commerce, retail media is another sort of all kind of merges together, social commerce, retail media. But yeah, that thing, I think what's actually I'm noticing is like, let's say if your digital journey, right, used to be like search, social, and then it was almost like programmatic display and video. And I'm sort of seeing it's going to go and reach, sorry, search, social, and for certain brands, it's the retail media aspect of it, social commerce, retargeting, and then a bit more sort of the programmatic display and video side. So I am seeing that the sort of performance area of the market is sort of extending into, you know, these retailers. And I think there's it's very easy for a lot of companies now to become to generate revenue through advertising by using their data or their inventory to sell it to other advertisers, basically. That is a trend that is picking up.
Interesting. Raj, does retail media basically is creating a glut of new publishers, if you like, I'm using air quotes. Does that concern, in terms of where budget allocation is happening, does that concern premium publishers like you that they might be putting money there instead of traditionally where they would have put it with you instead?
It's a big concern.
Interesting.
It is a big concern because, you know, not all brands or all products are built the same. Okay. So, so Halen, for example, everyone knows what Panadol does, right? But I'm just going to quote your example because we did a recent campaign with Panadol where there are different forms of Panadols. Yeah. So there is a Panadol for body ache, there's a Panadol for headache, and you should thank me later for this, yeah. But there was a post-vaccine care Panadol that they launched. So like post-vaccine,
what?
If you have a... I mean, it was one of
same
the...
Products. Same
of course, products. It's all the same ingredients, different packaging, very clever. Very good. Interesting.
Yeah. So you take that. There's a fever-based one and so on, right? Now, we all think we know Panadol as a product, right? And what it does and when we should take it. But you do need to tell the end consumer that these are the different kinds and which is the right one you should take. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to pop something that's not good for you. That's where I feel... Like, if you just go for performance, it's not going to it's not going to hit the mark. It's probably going to miss the mark because you don't want to be just selling tablets. You want to be telling someone what you need and why you need it and when you need it, really, right? So it presents a challenge because there are lots of brands that are purely focusing on performance metrics, purely focusing on page lands, time spent on page, and so on, right? But the building of the brand or building of the product, launching of a new product is all done through content, is all done through longer tail media, right? Whether it's branded content, whether it's video, whether even if it's social, right? Because that's where KOLs come in and, you know, put a camera in front of their face and talk about the product. And that's where I think that shift to just that... It's almost a mindless shift for a lot of brands to retail media. They want to do it as a FOMO. They don't really know what they want out of it. But as long as they do, as long as it's established first, and then they move into it as part of their 360 campaign planning, that's great.
Yeah, a very impassioned plea almost from you there. Don't forget about MediaCorp and the value that we can add
in your marketing mix. I want to, one final question. We have to talk about the future and the, I guess the role that AI could play in that. There's been a lot of conversations around ChatGPT and, you know, generative AI tools such as that. I want to understand, you know, for what role do you believe AI can play in the future of digital advertising? But also, you know, what role is it already playing? Actually, it's already very, very prevalent in various guises in the industry. It might not be AI, it could be more like advanced data programming, but still there's a lot happening. Caroline, I'm going to put you in the hot seat and come to you first on kind of where you're seeing it go, how Stack Adapt are potentially going to use it, and if you think that it's just all a bit, you know, load of fluff.
No, not at all. I mean, we are an AI platform. We were built as an AI platform. So actually, we feel we're already there. But then with regards to adopting new technology, of course, we'll be doing that. We'll be adopting all of the new technologies, including ChatGPT. You know, with regards to contextual, how do we utilize that? You know, we utilize our advanced AI learning to target people contextually. A really interesting, example here about Panadol. We can target those exact users in the exact frame of mind, and we can use AI to do all of that. So it's getting the right message, the right Panadol, in front of the right user at the right time.
Which is all the same Panadol, it turns out, after all. It's not the same. Gorman, what are you seeing from an AI perspective, you know, as another tech company? How are you guys using it?
I think just more internally as a workflow tool, it's really, really powerful. You know, there's a tool we're trialing right now. It's kind of like, you know, it kind of goes through your emails, and if you're on a Google Meet, and it just sort of writes all your follow-ups and things like that. So in terms of as a tool, an automation tool internally for our teams, that's an area where actually we're seeing a lot of benefit from. In terms of like when we're buying ads and, you know, building algorithms to predict what to buy, there's AI, machine learning and all that within that, and our clients kind of get that by default, I guess, whenever we come in. But I actually, what interests me the most about generative AI is how it can help our teams be more efficient.
I agree. And there's somebody in this room who actually uses AI to create bedtime stories for their children. So that's a useful tip for you if you aren't already doing that. I had a chat about that the other day. Very interesting. We are out of time. Thank you so much for listening to this. I've been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for your time. Silas, Gorman, Raj, Avis, and Caroline. Give them a round of applause. Thank you, everyone.